Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
Welcome to the ITSP Magazine Podcast Network, a modern, innovative multimedia platform broadcasting ideas and connecting minds. You are about to listen to the Cybercognition Podcast, a show that looks at humanity's role in the rapidly changing world of science and technology, with your hosts, Hutch and Len.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Cybercognition. I am Hutch, an innovation principal at Trace3. I'm the creator of the Socioexploit blog, and I'm also the author of the book, The Language of Deception, Weaponizing Next Generation AI.
And I am Len No, technical evangelist, transhuman, author of the upcoming book, Human Hacked, and general futurist. So thank you for being here with us. Let's get down to some fun.
All right. And in this episode, as always, we're going to talk about a few news articles that caught our interest. We're first going to discuss how Mark Zuckerberg has stooped to a whole new low in privacy. We're going to look at how Amazon Kindles are now advertising and promoting generative AI garbage on their devices. And we're also going to talk about how Microsoft and OpenAI is now in the process of building a $100 billion supercomputer monstrosity.
Yeah, and then that one when we get to it.
Yeah, for sure. It's scary stuff. And then from there, we're going to talk in our main segment about identity and authentication and some of the challenges related to those as we continue to move into a more digitalized age. So with that, we'll go ahead and jump into the news. So
creepy.
Yep, for sure. So Mark Zuckerberg, as always, up to no good. So there was a disclosure that came out of the discovery process in a lawsuit that was happening somewhere in Europe, since they actually take privacy seriously. And what came out of this was there was this discovery that Facebook at the time, now Meta, had acquired a VPN company. And they used that VPN in order to install certificates on end user devices in order to intercept and eavesdrop on not just Meta communication, which we all know they do, but actually eavesdrop on end users' interactions with competitive apps such as Amazon, Snapchat, YouTube. And to me, this seems absolutely criminal. I'm sure that they probably found a way to skirt around that by having some typical warnings legalese at the beginning that people click through and don't read. But the fact that we now have a company that is not only monetizing its own data, but thoroughly combing through and eavesdropping on the data of other applications is really concerning.
The thing that got me, Hutch, is this, if it was anybody else, you know, and even in the write-ups that you're seeing, they're using one specific term that just makes me as a former black hat just laugh hysterically, is how many times have you seen man in the middle attack being used in reference to a large company against not only their own people, but like you said, other applications. These are techniques that are typically reserved for offensive or nefarious actors.
Absolutely. This is malware.
This is sanctioned malware. And the thing that I find even creepier is the choice of competitive application they were going after. I mean, if you look at, you know, Snapchat and its original design and, you know, what it was designed for, it was designed for the temporary transmission of a bit of information that was extremely ephemerate and then gone. It was meant to be like the ultimate in privacy.
Yep.
And yet, here we go again, Mr. Zuckerberg.
Yeah, it is unbelievable how we continue to see Zuckerberg and Meta continue to stoop to. I mean, we had the Cambridge Analytica scandals. We've had all of the different problems with aggregation of data, as then again coming to a whole new low, which is saying something for Zuckerberg and Meta.
Yeah, and if you can actually read into this article, it looks like it extended beyond Snapchat, and eventually they expanded the program out to include Amazon and YouTube as well. So yep. You're getting buying habits, purchasing habits. You're getting your stats on your viewing. You're basically building a larger and larger data model on an individual. And as we get into today's main topic, I've got some serious issues, because that is something that is becoming more and more terrifying by the day.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting is that shortly after the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which I should mention is roughly around the same time frame here, because I think that this VPN application is no longer around. They sunset this, I think, in 2019. So this isn't something that's actively going on. It's something that we're finding out about now. But shortly after the Cambridge Analytica issues, there was a deposition of Mark Zuckerberg by a lot of our members of Congress. And it was funny because a montage video came out where one of the congressional members asked Mark Zuckerberg the question of, can Facebook see what I'm doing on Amazon or YouTube? And you know, what's funny is everybody in the world just scoffed at that person as if it was, you don't understand the internet. And even I thought the same thing as well. I never would have imagined that Facebook would have essentially implanted malware on user devices in order to be able to intercept data for other companies. So it can't be understated or overstated how bad this is.
This is as bad as it gets. This is like seriously 19. We keep saying this over and over on this podcast, but 1984 was not meant to be an instruction manual. You know, it was meant to be a warning. Oh my goodness. You know, I'd love to say I'm shocked, but I guess, you know, it just really validates the point that if you can't see the product that they're selling, the product is you.
Sure does. And speaking of products, so Kindle, the Amazon ebook reader and arguably the most popular ebook reader, has been seen basically promoting and advertising on the front of their, so whenever you're not actively reading something on your Kindle, it will display advertisements on the front of that Kindle. And
unless you
turn it off. I don't have a Kindle.
You can buy your way out of those advertisements.
Really? They charge you to not.
Correct. There is a $20 fee and you can turn those off. And I had to throw that in there just because I can't believe that it costs $20 after I buy a device to turn off the spam.
You had to pay for the commercial and then you have to pay to turn it off, huh?
Exactly.
Love it. I mean, so now those advertisements are frequently containing generative AI garbage. So I think we talked about this before, but Amazon now has this problem where people are essentially using generative AI to quickly create books, and they're selling books that are, the images are generated, the text is generated. And of course it's largely kind of non-creative derivative garbage. And what's interesting about this is that, and the article that we looked at points out that most of these books were not high rated. So how we're even getting to the point, and the author of the article was even confused and perplexed by this, of how we're getting to the point where these are even ending up in the advertisements. But if you look at many of the screenshots that are shown in this article, it is very clear that this content is generated. And I think we are once again in that situation. And we talked about this during our Idiocracy episode previously, but where we've got so much noise from generative AI that it's becoming challenging to find the real value in content out there on the internet and elsewhere.
You know, and the you keyed in a little bit right there, Hutch, on the point that I wanted to drive home. The, you know, when you look at Amazon and Kindle as, you know, like you said, the largest share in the e-reading population out there, how are these analytics being manipulated? How are these authors that are creating, like you said, very simplistic, no reviews? I mean, as an author on Amazon, you know, getting advertisement is directly driven by comments and, you know, responses for in interactions with your page. So how are, you know, where is that coming from? And how does Amazon even address this? Because this has been apparently going on for quite a while now.
Yeah, I think that any conclusions here are probably speculative. I think that we likely have algorithms that are happening in the back end with Amazon that are comparable to what, say, Google uses for SEO or search engine optimization. And as we know with SEO, there are likely ways that you can exploit those algorithms and figure out ways to bump yourself up to the top. So there's a possibility that there's some of that going on. There's also a possibility that I do know that Amazon will advertise content that's new because of the assumption that newer content may not have those reviews yet. And so it's possible that they're just cranking these out so quickly on a daily basis that Amazon sees it as new content. And so even though it doesn't have the reviews, they may be more likely to prefer those within advertisements, possibly a combination thereof, but still concerning that we are now seeing this as a regular trend.
You know, it makes me question whether or not we're going to start seeing more of this bleed over and where it's going to make its appearance next.
Yep. I'm sure we will continue to see it elsewhere also.
Okay. I want to point out one thing before I get you are Mr. AI Hutch, and I will yield that to you, but I was going to say, do you remember what year Skynet from the Terminator was supposed to take over?
I actually don't.
This to me looks like we're about to build Skynet.
I completely agree. So I guess for context, the article that we're talking about now is Microsoft and AI or OpenAI have now come together to decide to build a $100 billion neural network supercomputer. And for context, it is not publicly disclosed exactly how much it costs to build the latest frontier models like GPT-4, but the general consensus is probably somewhere in the single digit or low double digit millions. So probably somewhere between $5 to $15 million. And now we know, based on an article that was published, and this was published by, so the original one was published by The Information. And I tried to look at the original article to get a sense of where this information was coming from, if there was a public disclosure or if there was a leak or what. Unfortunately, it was paywalled. That being said, I would assume that there was some due diligence here because it's also been picked up and reiterated by multiple other very reputable media outlets like Reuters and others. So I think that there is likely some truth to this. And so, again, we are talking about something that is easily hundreds, if not thousands, of orders of magnitude more capable than the most impressive frontier systems. And we're talking about a timeline, so this is still a multi-year project, but we're looking at them completing all five phases of this project and having it rolled out by the end of the decade.
You know, and the thing that I find ironically funny is if you look back to our episode that we just recorded last in terms of privacy in the digital era, you know, if you take a look at the Gladstone report, which was the information that was given back to the Department of Defense in regards to recommendations to curb the threat of AI, you know, one of the things that they were talking about was throttling the amount of resources that could actually be given to a data model. The other was limiting access to the chips allowing the data model, you know, and this basically takes everything that was in those recommendations and just throws them right out the window, you know. But the other point that I wanted to ask, at least from a discussion perspective, is we're seeing this massive rush to technology for neural networks, you know, but at the same time, we've not really heard a lot coming out of the quantum camp over the last couple of months or years as well. So is this the potential of trying to move away from quantum and go more to neural? Or what happens when we start getting the advancements in qubits for quantum computing? Does this stuff even make sense anymore?
Yeah, I think that so of course the challenge with quantum computing is the absolute zero requirement. So that is the temperature required in order to stop the movement of matter. And that's essentially the only way that we've been able to manipulate. And I want to be careful here, because I quantum is admittedly a bit over my pay grade, but my understanding. Also,
that said, we're talking in generalities and theoretical at this point.
Yeah, but my understanding is that while we are seeing progress in the ability to manipulate matter at the quantum level, and there have been a number of challenges. Like, you'll see everything from like quantum entanglement, where the photon particles are not even necessarily directly connected to each other, but that the change of state of one impacts the state of another. And so there's a lot of really weird stuff that happens at that quantum level. And I do know that we've made quite a bit of progress there, but I think the biggest obstacle is, as long as we have to operate in an absolute zero temperature environment, then I don't think we get to a point where there's at least an ability to use on a distributed level something like quantum computing. And I think we certainly are still hitting limitations as far as how much we can scale those out. But theoretically, if we get to a point where it is usable and we can scale it, I think that only further exacerbates all of the other challenges that we've seen with scaling, because then you can do something with the atomic level piece of matter that would previously require hundreds or thousands, possibly millions more pieces of material or mass, yes, or matter to achieve the same. So it'll be interesting to see how these things converge over time, because I do think that if quantum computing does get to a point where it is more feasible, we are going to see a convergence between that and artificial intelligence, and possibly in a frighteningly fast moving way, even compared to what we're seeing today.
I agree with you 100% that, and unfortunately, call it a prediction, but there's no way that these technologies do not intersect at some point in the future.
Yep, agreed. All right. With that, let's go ahead and jump over into our main segment. So we're going to talk about identity, and specifically some of the challenges that are coming up related to identity in the modern world. And so before we do that, I wanted to set the stage for a few different terms that I think are important here, because I think that they are interrelated and sometimes confused, but important to understand the difference between these. So of course, identity is who you are. Authentication is then how you prove who you are. And then authorization is what you're allowed to do once you've proven that you are who you are.
Save.
And of course, the typical approach in information security historically has been to prove identity in one of three ways. And that is something you know, something you have, and something you are. And as we've moved forward in this digital era, it seems that we are encountering more and more unique problems with each one of these, where it is becoming apparent that some of the traditional ways that we've employed these types of factors of authentication are becoming more challenging. And I guess I probably should take a step back for just a moment and clarify what I mean by something you know, something you have, and something you are. So of course, something you know is our traditional idea of a password or maybe recovery questions. Something you have is something like a hardware token or an access card, something physical that you can hold on to. And then something you are is proving your identity through your biological signatures. So biometrics, fingerprints, retinal scans, facial recognition. Lynn, anything you wanted to add to those?
We'll get into it in a minute, but you know, there's also the idea of something that's been incorporated into you. You know, see, this is for those futurists that listen to me because I'm completely off the reservation. You know, as Hutch was saying, something you have, something you know, something you are. I am going to show, for those that are actually going to watch this on YouTube, I'm going to do a demonstration today of something that's integrated into you as an additional factor for trying to do an authentication. Yep. So where do you even want to start this discussion? Because my opinion, I'm going to throw it out there right in the beginning and say there is no unique identifier for an individual human being left that cannot be duplicated, spoofed, counterfeited, or simply bypassed.
Yeah, and I completely agree. And I think let's talk through them one by one, kind of each of those Absolutely. Different types of factors. So let's talk first about something you know. So the tradition, because I think that for most people, when they think of authentication, that's the first thing they think of is passwords.
Absolutely.
And password. I think before we even get into the passwords, I think an interesting one that has been a huge challenge, which was kind of the first something you know, even before we had passwords on digital platforms, we had social security numbers. And we still use these 10-digit numbers to this day in the United States in order to identify who we are. And the assumption, and it is a very flawed assumption, is that if you know a social security number and other basic details about who somebody is, that is sufficient in order to prove that you are that person. So I think it's been interesting to see the evolution of this, because there have been a lot of very good alternatives that have been recommended, but we have never seen buy-in from the U.S. federal government. And there are serious problems with social security numbers as being a way of authenticating or proving that you are who you say you are. One of those is the fact that you can't revoke social security numbers.
And even beyond that, if we were going to use the social security number as a proof of a validation, that should then be separated from financial transactions, medical. It should be used as a top level identifier only, you know, kind of like what they do with some of the national IDs over in the European Union.
Right. And I think that unfortunately, that's what we don't really see that in practice, though, right? We see that organizations will just ask you for your social security number. And if you know it, you are who you say you are. It's not just an ID to track you over multiple systems. It becomes an authentication mechanism, which I don't know much about the original foundational concepts of when they built the social security number. I don't know if it was intended to just be an identity tracker over multiple different systems and groups, or if it was intended to be used for authentication, but it certainly has been used for authentication and still is to this day.
To my understanding, the social security number was implied once we started looking into taxing people and allowing, you know, services post-retirement and things, and there had to be a universal identifier. But the fact that we've moved beyond that, it's absolutely asinine. You know, like you said, once this is, what happens to people like me who travel? Do you know how many times, honestly, Hutch, my identity has been compromised since I started working in this field and working for it instead of against it?
Oh, I have no doubt. Yeah, I think most people have at least had a couple.
You know, and what do you do? You know, there's, you know, identity insurance, you know, and I'm not pushing one brand or another, But, you know, I remember there was one company at one point, I believe it was called LifeLock, where the CEO of the company, you know, to your point, drove a truck around major metropolitan areas saying this is my name and this is my social security number. And it was his actual information. And it was meant to promote the protection services of this identity protection solution. I do believe he actually got his stuff compromised, if I'm not mistaken.
Multiple times. Yeah. So I mean, that, and I think there's two lessons to be learned there. One is that this is an extremely hard thing to safeguard when you talk about identity, and especially with so many organizations relying on social security number as an authentication for identity. But the second is never challenge hackers with, you can't hack me. Here's my data.
It never ends well if you talk to hackers in extremes. Yep. You know, but to take that one step further, you know, let's take one step down. You went from the social security number. I know for a fact, at least within the CVS, Walgreens kind of pharmaceutical, you know, chains within the United States. And I complain about this every time I go in to pick up medication or whatnot. Okay, what's your name? What's your birthday? That is all you need to do to validate a pharmaceutical pickup in the United States. And I tell the pharmacist every time, I was like, can we please pick something that I can't take off of somebody's Facebook profile page? We're using validators, at least from a face-to-face and a discussion perspective, based upon PII that we are freely giving away. So how does that even make sense?
Yeah, and circling back to the point I made previously, I mean, revocation is also a big issue. You can't, once your social security number has been compromised, you can't revoke it. You can't get a new one. It is what you are stuck with. And once it's out there, a wise person once said, that which has been interneted cannot be uninterneted. Once it's out there, it's out there.
Well, you know, theoretically, you can get a new one, but it does require some Monero, a little bit of an onion router, some Tor. But yeah, you can get another social security number.
Oh, interesting.
Just not legal.
So some of the alternatives that I've seen that are intriguing and I think make a lot of sense is something like using PKI infrastructure, private public key pairs. And yep. The value of this is, one, that you could revoke a key. There are already frameworks that allow you to check for key revocation, but also the idea that you would never actually have to transfer the value of your identity. So if my identity is tied to a private key, then rather than passing, I would never share that private key. I would instead use that private key to sign an assertion that could then be decrypted with my public key. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I mean, you think about it with social security numbers, every form that I fill out, wherever I go, always asks for a social security number. And I usually try to push back wherever I can and say, do you really need this? Is this required? But for most people, they are anything they enroll in, it's everywhere that you are writing that down. And so you are constantly making a paper trail that has the explicit value that is tied to your identity, and it's all over the place. So the idea that this wasn't, I mean, we all know how this story ends. This was inevitably, it doesn't matter who you are. I can guarantee you your social security number is compromised. It's out there.
Absolutely. Guaranteed. You know, and I agree with you 100%, you know, but, and I also agree on the idea that any type of future system should have some type of public key, private key structure in place. But how do you key that back to an individual? You know, that's where it becomes difficult. You know, I know I'm kind of jumping around a little bit, but you basically went to where I think, you know, the idea of individual identity and validation of that identity is going to wind up becoming. You know, but we have skipped every single other option for biometrics. So I would rather personally spend more time here, but can we both agree that any current biometric authentication options out there are fallible and cannot be used as a 100% source of protection.
So you've definitely done more research in this area than I have. And you did a fantastic keynote presentation that I believe was more or less titled "Biometrics is Dead." Mm-hmm. And you made some fantastic points. And I guess there's it's been obviously a couple of years since you did that presentation, so some of it's a little bit foggy in my brain. I know one recent development that we've seen since was a research study that basically showed that just by moving your finger across a touch screen, researchers were able to basically recreate your fingerprints, which it wasn't 100% effective. It was, I think, about 33% of the time they were able to do like a partial recovery. About 10% of the time they were able to do full recovery of those fingerprints. And technology only gets better. So,
well, I mean, if you think about it, most mobile devices, you know, if you just pick it up and look at it, what do you see? Smears of everything that you've been doing.
Yep. Good point. I mean,
it's not hard to, you know, but even beyond that, with the advancements in digital photography, we've actually been able to lift fingerprints off of digital photographs. And that was actually one of the things that was done to, I believe it was Ursula von der Leyen, and that was the German defense minister. And that was done by the Chaos Computer Club out of Berlin, or excuse me, out of Germany. You know, retinal scans. I mean, most people think that retinal scans and iris scans are the same thing. You know, and the fact is there's two separate technologies. And what most people have in their mobile devices, if you're running an Apple iOS and you're doing the facial authentication, that is one of the weakest biometric authentication engines there is. You know, and before we move on to that, when it comes to any type of biometric authentication to a technological device, you're not really authenticating to your fingerprint or your face or the scan of your eyes. It's just like any other technology. When you first register your face or your fingerprints, it's creating what is called a biometric template, which is just a collection of data points that it will use to compare when you try and put your fingerprint or your face up there. But these are files, just like a public key or a private key, not the same technology, but it's a file. And I want to stop at the facial recognition for just a minute, because it was released about 3 weeks ago that there is now biometric stealing malware that's affecting iOS devices. So when you go to scan, if your phone gets infected, it's basically making a copy of your biometric data template and then sending it to an attacker. So Hutch, you're talking about social security numbers can't be revocated. What about once your face has been mapped? What about once your fingerprints have been converted to a digital template that is now just another file that can be traded between devices? It's not just the social security number. The entire identity system in the United States, along with, you know, the current concepts for authentication to technology, are taking huge risks. And this is not safe tech.
Yeah, I think it has made for an interesting journey, because I think we look back a couple decades ago and biometrics was the Rolls Royce of authentication. And that was just because of the fact that we didn't have technology that was sufficiently powerful enough to compromise it at that point. But I think we're now at a point where we're starting to see those dominoes fall one after another. We're seeing voice capabilities that are getting closer and closer to being able to replicate our voice signatures. We're seeing the deep fake videos that can replicate us visually. AI,
you know, they have been able to actually, there's been some proof of concepts done with deep fake voice AI, where they're actually able to, it was passphrase, it wasn't password. You know, and for the difference, password is to speak, it'll look at your camber and cadence of your voice, and you could basically say whatever you want. Passphrase is it's recording specific words spoken in a pattern. and passphrase was broken with deepfake audio AI.
And there's a lot of banks that actually use that as their authentication mechanism in order to get access to your financial data. But it's interesting because I mentioned that biometrics used to be kind of the best option. And now I feel like as we're getting to a point where biometrics is starting to become more and more susceptible to compromise, is it possibly the worst option now? Because of, to your point, it can't be revoked. You can't change your eye patterns, your facial structure, your fingerprints. Well,
to be honest, the black hat in me is going to come out for just a second, as well as the privacy advocate in me. I've never been a fan of biometric authentication, but for a completely different reason. There is no protections under the law for biometrics. They're considered part of the plain view doctrine. The only thing that we as citizens here within the
United States, can they force you to unlock your phone or something if you're interested?
If you are arrested and with an iPhone, there is nothing against the law from an officer walking up, holding that phone up to your face, unlocking your phone and start looking through your stuff. There's no law that prevents them from doing that. There is no law that prevents a law enforcement to you come up, take your hand, put your fingerprint on the scanner, open your device.
I would have thought, and I would imagine most people probably think the same, that would have fallen into the same self-incrimination restriction.
But here's the thing, right? It is not considered privileged. If I can literally walk up to you on the street and take a picture of your face, it's not considered privilege. The only thing that you have legal protections under the law in the United States for is either a passphrase or a passcode. This is why you cannot be compelled to give up your password to log into your device. But yes, if you get caught and you're using biometrics, the authorities can use those on you against your will. And there is no law that says that they can't.
Wow.
So
yeah, that's scary stuff.
For me, it's password or passcode only.
Yep. Well, speaking of bio signatures, not quite, I'm not sure. You mentioned that there was your implant that kind of allows you a way to, I guess, that is revocable.
It is revocable.
But
One of the many different implants that I have is from a company called the VivoKey. And the VivoKey originally started out as a way to authenticate against web apps. The original chips were known as the VivoKey Spark 1 and the Spark 2. The only difference between the Spark 1 and the Spark 2 was the version of the NFC chip inside that would allow for background process read on Apple iOS devices. So the Spark 1 would only work for Android, Spark 2 would work for Androids or iPhone. This was one of the first identity chips that I had implanted. This is one of the little bioglass ones, and it's up here in the webbing of my right hand between my thumb and my pointer finger. This allowed me to do web authentication into the VivoKey forums. It was basically the only authentication method that was allowed into certain locations. You had to be one of us in order to get in. But the chip itself, it is the backbone for their authentication method. But they have a different chip out now that is called the VivoKey Apex. And most people, when they hear about me and my implants, it's always about, you know, I'm breaking into somebody's phone by touching it. I'm bypassing physical security. This particular chip is actually a cryptobionic chip with high cryptographic capabilities. It has a companion application on my cell phone. And for anybody that's just listening, this would be an opportunity where I was saying I invite you to come over and check out the video stream, because I'm actually going to take a moment and I'm going to actually show what it looks like to actually authenticate with an implant. So we've talked about something you have, something you are. So this, well, I hate to do this, but I'm going to have to turn the blur off. So please forgive my background. But we have an app on the phone, and all I have to do is actually hold this up to my arm to where my implant is. So once I authenticate to my chip, this actually gives me access to transmit a business card. I can have a Tesla key on here. The one that I want to show off is the authenticator. So this is your standard OTP style authenticator. The difference is, in order to get additional codes after the first one, you have to rescan the implant. So this is something I have: cell phone, password in my head, implant. This can also act as the authenticator to my crypto wallet. So it's been suggested that something, not necessarily this particular chip, but something like this could act as the source of truth for an individual human. But the only issues I really see with that is this would need to be some type of a global service, because what happens if my chip here in the United States doesn't have reciprocity with, say, a country in Europe? We need to look at the concept of identity and identity validation as a global issue that is affecting all humanity and not just a US or a European problem, because we all have the same problem that we can all basically be stolen in terms of identity, as well as anything that physically upon us through deep fake.
Yeah, I think it is a challenge. It's definitely somewhat of a catch 22 where, I mean, you can do the national or more local implementations and you can probably more easily get buy-in, but you're right, you don't fully solve the problem. You've also got the option of doing global, but it's so much harder to get universal buy-in. It's hard enough at a national scale, but at a global scale, I think that is going to be a big obstacle for adoption of something like that. But definitely interesting to see the new technology and the options that are out there.
Yeah. And, you know, if you look at certain services that are out there, you know, the idea of trying to find validators, you know, within either applications, give me a second. I've got this app on my phone. I just can't remember what it's called. Keybase, if you're familiar with them. Another service that allows public key, private key, basically validation on almost like a digital sign, being able to sign a digital certificate for your emails or your social media. But the one thing that I really, and I've been saying this for years, I think the idea of identity insurance as we move forward into this new technical future is going to become as common as homeowners insurance or auto insurance. I don't see how it couldn't.
Yeah, just because it's becoming so easy to compromise, right?
Between OSINT, what we're literally just giving away through just normal use of the internet. I mean, case in point, if, you know, and I'm not suggesting that anybody do this because I'm a good guy now, you know, but let's say you or me, Hutch, if somebody decided to go run an OSINT report on us, how much have we given away? Will they figure out our family members? Would they figure out our wives, children, you know, where we live? There is no privacy anymore. And at this point, I feel that, you know, trying to maintain, and this is going to sound really strange coming from a transhuman, but I think trying to find ways to secure our individual humanities is going to become a very precious commodity.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, with that, before we wrap it up, there was one that we didn't tackle. We kind of did, but the topic of something you have, which I think is interesting, because a lot of times I think that the something you have and the something you know become somewhat entangled. And what I mean by that is, a lot of times you'll have something like what you just showed with the one-time pass, where it'll have a rotating value. And while it's true that it is on a device that I may have possession of, there's definitely an argument for, at the time when I enter that into some kind of system to authenticate myself, it is something that I know, something that I'm aware of, because I look at that app and then I pass it to the application. And so I think it becomes subject to some of the same types of attacks that the original form of authentication, the something you know, the password, is subject to. It's phishable, it's replayable. And I think that this really came to light and was most apparent during the RSA breach, which happened about a decade ago. But if you remember, we used to have those old hardware RSA tokens that people would carry around on their keychains. And it used to be, it was mostly like either like federal government workers or highly sensitive companies that actually used these. But it was just a dongle that would have a 6-digit key that would rotate based on
time. The same thing that you're seeing on your cell phone, but this was before the proliferation of OTP applications. It was a standalone piece of hardware that did the exact same thing.
Yep. And so there is a standard algorithm that's used for time-based one-time pass authentication. And if you have the seed value that's used for that device, then you can essentially deduce at any given time what the actual current value is. And the RSA database was breached and all of those seed values got released. And of course, people were then able to authenticate as those users, which really begged the question of, am I really authenticating with something that I have if somebody else can still authenticate with that code without actually having the physical key that I have? It really is, to some extent, something you know. And so I think it's been interesting to see kind of how those two have become entangled. I think the one exception to that is FIDO, which is where the device itself truly does authenticate to the service with cryptographic routines. And I think you mentioned that your VivoKey implant actually does support FIDO compliant MFA as well.
It is FIDO 2 compliant as well.
Yep.
You know, so this is like one of the reasons where I was saying, maybe transhumans are the future, not necessarily because we want to upgrade ourselves, but maybe we want to remain individual. Maybe we want to protect our own identity, and the only way to do so is to actually have some type of third-party application chip implanted. But at that point, what does that do to our humanity? You know, do I exist without it? You know, and as a transhuman, these are the philosophical things that I think about all the time. You know, if we move to this kind of a society where you do need an implant to be able to validate that you are who you say you are, if you're somebody who doesn't necessarily want to get this, does that then create a new socioeconomic situation for you? You know, is it going to be does it turn into something where if you don't adopt the technology, you won't be able to access services? You know, when you start dealing with the human body, even though I have no problem doing it, it can get out of control very, very quickly.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a hard one to mandate. And especially, and we discussed this before the podcast, but I think in the very least, we would have to get to something that is, I think more people are tolerant of the level of invasion required. And if I recall, I think you said that VivoKey one is a decent size implant, right? It's not like a grain of rice or anything.
No. This is to get this put in, you're using a piercing needle that's about the size of a pen.
Whew. Yep.
To that point, you know, I was just making some edits to my book coming up. And that was one of the things that I was, you know, trying to find a way to phrase, you know, and I'm going to leave it with this. This will be my final statement for this episode. You know, everybody was, if we think back to COVID, you remember everybody was afraid they were getting a GPS or some kind of tracker put into them. And I did the math. The smallest glass implant that you could actually have put in you is a minimum of 2 millimeters in diameter. So that's about a little over 1/16 of an inch. The standard needles that were used for the vaccines were like 0.5, you know, 0.7 millimeters.
So what you're saying is we don't have GPS tracking nanobots going through our body since the...
This is not that kind of thing. You know, if you're going to become a transhuman or start implanting technology, you're going to know it. This is not, you know, God forbid you're diabetic. These are not those little needles that you go, I didn't even notice I had got stabbed. You will know.
But right now you will, right? I mean, I think we get to the point at some point in the near future where these things do become smaller, less invasive, right?
Potentially, but at this point, we have to look at everything when it comes to a transhuman perspective. Even when it comes to the VivoKey and the identity chips, they require that second factor of a reader in order to energize the chips and transmit the data.
Something external that powers it.
Absolutely. The main differing limitation for any type of advanced technology inside the human body is the restrictions against internal power, because that's currently regulated by the FDA. Unless you want to go complete old school grinder and hook a, you know, a 9-volt up and coat it in some epoxy. And I'm just not that guy. I'm okay with taking risks, but I don't want to die.
Sounds messy.
So in conclusion, you know, identity security and where does it leave us? I think it leaves us more confused than we were when we got here.
I think we are going to continue to see more and more challenges as we move forward. It's the same problem that we're seeing with a lot of things. Technology is moving so fast, and we are trying to tackle those challenges as they're coming up, and being able to tackle those as fast as they're emerging with as fast as technology is moving is becoming harder and harder. And identity is no exception to that.
Well, maybe we'll just let the AI give us our identities once it becomes our lord and overlords and starts telling us what to do.
Once they deploy that $100 billion supercomputer.
Yeah, once that $100 billion neural network comes online, it'll just tell us who we are. So with that, thank you very much for your time, Hutch. I enjoyed the day's conversation. Thank you all for listening.
Yep, thanks. And as always, Cybercognition, over and out. Cheers.
Peace.
Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Cybercognition Podcast with Hutch and Len, part of the ITSP Magazine Podcast Network. If you like the story, add this show to your favorite podcast player and share the Cybercognition Podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to connect your brand to this show and its audience, visit ITSPMagazine.com to learn how to sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey.